It's time for Skin in the Game, and we have your front row seat to the action with marketing expert John Simperman and sports business journalist Tim Oshai.
They're talking about a $1 billion renovation.
Which is incredible.
And that's
for a hockey arena in the South, too, right?
That includes hotels.
Skin in the Game brings you the fresh and fascinating business news in the world of sports, a multi-billion dollar industry that has an economic impact on all of us.
This week, we sit down with Demoris Smith, the former NFL Players Association executive director and the author of Turf Wars, to discuss the power, labor, and the business behind professional football.
I never wanted to write a book that turned every NFL fan into a hater. I wanted to write a book that hopefully made you even enjoy the game more, knowing that there is this battle royale going on behind the scenes.
Coming up next on Skin in the Game, right after this.
Support for BTPM comes from our members and from Holiday Valley. Holiday Valley has winter fun everyone can agree on. Holiday Valley was voted the #4 resort in the East by Ski Magazine readers. Holiday Valley features mountain coaster rides, snow tubing, the Tamarack Club Spa, and of course, skiing and snowboarding. At Holiday Valley, you can just relax too. Winter starts here. More information at holidayvalley.com.
Hey, welcome to a new episode of Skin in the Game. I'm John Simperman with my co-host.
I am Tim Oshai.
Hey, Tim. Also, hey, we want to thank again Holiday Valley for being a presenting partner of Skin in the Game.
John, I hope everybody out there listening and watching joins us down at Holiday Valley. Come on down to Ellicottville. It's a great town, great resort year-round, but no time better than winter to check out Holiday Valley.
That's right. Tim, it's going to be a football episode of Skin in the Game as the NFL season here is wrapping, or by the time this is here, probably wrapping up. But I got to tell you, we hit, to use a baseball term, a home run with our upcoming guest.
Yeah, we sure did, John. And I'm always good for a football episode. And I know you are, too.
We were overdue.
We like to vary it up here on Skin in the Game. Today, we've got Demoris Smith, the longtime and now former executive director of the NFL Players Association. Incredible guests who wrote one of the most interesting books I've read in a long time, Turf Wars.
Yeah. First of all, thanks for bringing Demoris to the show. I mean, 15 years he led the NFL Players Association, which I will argue were probably the most dramatic 15 years in the NFL history. He shepherded in, along with, you know, a lot of great players, very, very important times in the NFL. And what a character he is. And I say character in a good way, tons of energy. He was just a great, great person to sit down with.
I will say, John, and we get into this in the conversation with him, if you are somebody he worked with, negotiated with across the aisle, I don't know that all those guys would say Demoris Smith is, you know, a fun, a fun conversation partner. He's got it in him. But yeah, I mean, you can tell when you read the book, when you hear him talk, Demoris, who is a lawyer, he's tough. He comes in with a strong pro player, pro union mentality, which is, of course, exactly what you'd expect. He has tough opinions about NFL officials, tough opinions about NFL owners. And that's fine.
That's fine.
That's good. And it makes for great conversation and fascinating reading.
Yeah. Well, I got to tell you, you know, if I were a player if I needed, you know, any legal representation, you know, Demoris Smith is someone I'd love to have in my court.
If you're a football player, you want him on your side.
Yeah,
and that's what he was for 15 years.
Yeah. So the book is, and we're going to get into it, Turf Wars, The Fight for the Soul of America's Game. Great book, and we both had a chance to read it. So really encourage our listeners to stay tuned to our interview with Demoris Smith. But before that, you know, let's talk a little news. And since this is kind of a football-themed episode, lots to get into right now. And Tim, I think speaking of labor and player representation, you know, it does not look like the players right now, according to their words, have the appetite for an 18-game schedule. In other words, adding another regular season game to the schedule.
Yeah, and this has been a conversation for so long, right? I mean, first it was, how do we get, from the NFL's point of view, from 16 to 17. Damaris Smith writes about that one in Turf Wars, right? Yeah. And now, going up to 18, I can't say I'm surprised. Were you?
No, not at all surprised. You know, something, this is all about negotiation, but there are some concerns, injury concerns. Just look at the NFL season now. You know, you've got so many stars, players who are getting hurt games 14, 15, 16. So, and personally, this is my opinion, I don't think the NFL should continue to add games because you really start to dilute the product. Not only, the players susceptible to injury, but also, what made the NFL so special was must-see viewing, limited schedule. Every game matters. And when you start to add games, in my opinion, you start to dilute the product.
And I agree with you. When you think about it from the NFL point of view, you're creating product, right? You're creating product. You can put it on TV, put it in front of sponsors. What do you think, John, is the tipping point? How much is, maybe 18 is the answer, but how much is too much?
If you add an 18th game and the league just announced it's going to do a minimum of 8 international games next year, Australia, Paris have been added to the schedule. So not only adding an 18th game, but then you look at the wear and the tear on the players and the staffs, to be traveling to these international games. In my humble opinion, I think we're at that point where let's build the game, let's strengthen the schedules, but international travel, an 18th game, I don't know when enough is enough, but I think we're getting close.
But I am glad to see the NFL really stretching around the globe. I get your point, though. I mean, the wear and tear on the players, taking away product from the home game fan or the home team fans too, you really do have to strike a balance there. And yeah, maybe, I mean, stretching it to 18, you might just be pushing your roster a little too far.
Right.
You know, it comes back to the injuries, which is another thing. I mean, Damaris Smith and Turf Wars writes all about, right? Like keeping these men safe and how the NFL needs to do more in his view.
Right. The players' collective bargaining agreement goes through 2030. There's going to be a lot of conversation about this over the next few months. Hey, Tim, I just wanted to just give you a highlight and just kind of get a check of your bank account. I'm thinking about we might want to run a spot in the Super Bowl this year for Skin in the Game.
I think we should. Yeah, I'll go halves with you. How much will halves
cost
me?
That would be $5 million a piece because right now the going rate for a Super Bowl commercial is $10 million.
I mean, as long as we make it a good one, like a real, what would a good one be, John? That's your idea.
Just for reference, the first Super Bowl ad ever in 1967 ran about $37,000. So today, $10 million. Just goes to show, the power of the NFL and the strength of their viewership.
What is your favorite ever Super Bowl ad?
Just call me old school, nostalgia. It's got to be the Clydesdales, right? That's just Americana, and those are probably the ones that are always most memorable.
Good call. I'll go with that.
So looking forward to this interview. Please stay with us. Today we're talking to Damaris Smith, the author of Turf Wars and 15 years leading the NFL Players Association. Stay tuned for that interview. Skin in the Game. We'll be right back.
Support for BTPM comes from our members and from Holiday Valley. Whether it's a beginner's or Black Diamond Trail, Holiday Valley features skiing and terrain at every level. There's also a team of snow sports instructors available to sharpen your skills and build your confidence. Holiday Valley was voted the number 4 resort in the East by Ski Magazine readers. Winter starts here. More information at holidayvalley.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Skin in the Game. Damaris Smith, thank you for joining us.
Man, just a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
I know I speak for John and for myself. We really both enjoyed reading Turf Wars. For people out there who are football fans or absolutely in, I haven't met anyone who's in love with the NFL. They're in love with teams, not with the league. But for those who want a feel-good story about football, it's not quite that.
Yeah.
But if they want a candid story about what makes this game move forward or maybe what stops the game from moving forward, you really delivered. So tell us about your motivation for writing the book.
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head. If for the people who just want to live in the pure fan world, you know, go see the Ronald Reagan win one for the Gipper movie, perhaps even Rudy. But I wanted to write a book that framed really the history of the league, put it in context of obviously my nearly 15 years of running a labor union. I didn't want to ignore the importance of trade unionism, not only for the NFL players, but also the way trade unionism has fit so importantly, or I should say impactfully, in the American story, but also not shy away from issues of race and power and money. And look, I never wanted to write a book that turned every NFL fan into a hater. I wanted to write a book that hopefully made you even enjoy the game more, knowing that there is this battle royale going on behind the scenes that, you know, as some of my friends would say, perhaps makes you a more ethical watcher. And for that, certainly there was going to be some people who read the book that wouldn't necessarily be happy. I'm pretty sure I'm not going to be getting any holiday gifts from the owners. If that box arrived at the door, I'd perhaps give it to John to open. But I wanted to write a book that was true. Obviously, it's from my perspective. There's a lot of lore that goes around sport, and a lot of that is good. There's a lot of lore that goes around sport, and I think for a lot of reasons, a lot of it is bad. Turf Wars is something that I wanted to write a book that I thought, you know, Saul Alinsky would dig.
Yeah. Good morning, thanks again for joining us. I was blown away by the attention to detail and the recollection of stories that, you know, go back, what, 14, 15 yeah. years? I mean, you must have been one heck of a note taker back in the day, because just, you know, those stories seem so topical. How did you go back into, you know, 14 years of history to rekindle that?
I would show you the rest of my office, but I would be embarrassed. My office is just full of notebooks. You know, one of the best pieces of advice I got when my first year in law school, my philosophy professor, you know, they didn't call it journaling back then. He said, keep a diary. And that became really something that started in 1986 and never ended. The nature of the job in the National Football League, especially if you kind of find yourselves as we did from anybody, you know, I won't spoil anything in the book by saying it was 14 years full of fights with the National Football League. I mean, that is not going to be a spoiler. And those fights kind of play out in the context of collective bargaining, lawsuits, litigation. So it lends itself for a lawyer to naturally take notes. I obviously had to stay away from the things that were privileged. But for good and for bad, and I do mean mostly for bad, the stories were just kind of seared into me. And the note-taking was just a thing that, you know, was cathartic in a way, but also necessary for me to do my job. You know, I came into this business not really knowing anything about sports. So I kind of approached it as a overly indulgent, anal retentive lawyer. And unfortunately, man, we know how to take a lot of notes.
What I found was interesting, too, is you just brought it up. You weren't necessarily a sports fan. You weren't necessarily a football fan, with the exception of going to some Redskins games with your father. When I was hiring people to work for a sports team, if the first thing they said was, I'm a real big fan of this team, I would immediately cross them off the list.
100%. 100%. I know that sounds counterintuitive,
right,
for folks, but when you have a job inside of sport, you know, what I always try to remind students, you know, I want to be an agent, I want to be an executive, I want to work for a team. You know, the first thing you have to level set is you are not going to be out back pitching the ball back and forth between you and Drew Brees. That's not the day. The job within sport, I think, is easier and to a certain extent better accomplished with people who are not fans, because the fan part will color the way in which you do the job. And for a lawyer whose job is literally myopically to make the players better tomorrow than they were yesterday, you have to consider that the game, the team, the lore of football, the fandom, all of those things are whatever it is, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, 25th, 30th. You know, I'll never forget getting to that emotional and philosophical point in that job to say, oh, wait, you know, I have to philosophically believe that my job one day might be recommending that no one play football, right? Because that's right. The only way to keep yourself honest that you're absolutely doing everything you can to make the game safer. If you are trying to square the game with safety at some point, and the league is very good at this, they leverage the game against you. You know, I'll never forget, for example, you know, Mark Murphy, who knew better, when we were talking about concussions, you know, we were talking about the need to have a person on the field to make that decision. And it sometimes take that decision out of the hands of the team physician.
Sure.
And, you know, Mark Murphy played for years. He was a former vice president of the NFLPA. You know, at the time he was the head of the Green Bay Packers. And I remember him saying, hey, D, well, you know, that's really going to interrupt the flow of the game. Why don't we just make sure the doctor is like nearby in the stands? And, you know, that's so absurd. But I think that when you approach it as the game should come first, you see how you get there. And I wanted to make sure that there was never a moment in my career where I was trading the game for the people that I was sworn to represent.
You know, it was interesting to me, DeMorris. You write about a scene where you're in a locker room, and I think you said this in many locker rooms, maybe all of them, where you introduced yourself to the players and said, you know, I don't care about the game of football. I care about the guys who play football. I'm curious, were you able to get that message through? Like, I don't care what happens on the field. Yeah. Well, I don't care about who wins, who loses. I'm not watching as a fan. I care about you. Did they get that?
I think they got that because that was one of the easier sells, to be dead honest with you, because I think the one thing that I do love, and I did love about working with players, is they have a acute bullshit monitor. And, you know, when it comes to a coach where they know the coach doesn't really care about them, their families, whether they're hurt or not, to a certain extent, they know even their agents are there because there's a financial relationship. They know that the owner is there and he might come down after the game and say, great game. But every player knows that no owner is going to lose a lick of sleep if that guy's got to throw himself into an ice bath in order to get into his car to drive home. So I think when they heard that there was somebody who actually didn't care, and I would even add that I'm likely not going to even watch you on Sunday, it was just honest. It is a group of people who have dealt with a group of people who haven't been tremendously honest with them for years. That was a pretty easy sell. Now, the first time that I went into a locker room and said that we have to hit less and take less painkillers, let's just say I've had easier days.
Yeah. So, DeMorris, I know that, you know, your initial getting into the job wasn't to be that of a fan, but representing the players as objectively as possible. Now that you've had a chance to step away from the day-to-day of running the Players Association, you know, are you watching more football? Can you actually maybe enjoy it now?
I probably watch more football this year than I have for the last 15. I mean, the college games have been to me absolutely bananas. I still don't really watch a lot of regular season games. It's just, I don't think I'll ever be that, you know, 9 a.m. in the morning fan till midnight.
Right.
You know, there's just too many books to read. Just too many books. I have a thing about the New York Times Sunday paper, like from beginning to end, that I just crave. And that's just too hard to fit in with too many games over the Sundays. But honestly, I probably watch more this year than all 14 years combined.
Well, you said about reading books, and I see there you've got quite the library behind you. But, you know, when it comes to a book like Turf Wars, you're writing books. You know, we've had a few authors on here, you know, at Skin in the Game, and we've had anywhere from, 2 years to 8 years to write a book. What was the duration for this one?
The idea of it started in, I would say, late 2013, early 2014. Once we got through the lockout, and then, you know, I don't know, we went, I forget what gate we went into, what any given years between, you know, Deflategate, Bountygate, Ray Rice, Kaepernick, you know, all of it kind of strung together. But I do remember coming out of the lockout, or at least 2 years coming out of the lockout, thinking, okay, this is something that is so unique that nobody's really written about what this is, but it certainly fits into traditional frames of the civil rights movement, the trade unionist movement, that I felt that I wanted to write something that wasn't, that again, wasn't a third and long book. By the time I got to 2015, 2016, I just became convinced if I didn't write this, who would?
Right.
You know, for folks who kind of live in that world where we feel like so many authors before us gave us the tools, you know, by which we somehow, you know, maneuver our way through our future, you know, A Whole Different Ball Game by Marvin Miller. And I, you know, I talk about Marvin a lot in the book because he both terrified me and inspired me. I'm not sure which one was more, you know, so much of what we did was, at least to me, inspired by Saul Alinsky and, you know, the people who were the architects of the civil rights movement. The business of football is such a strange ecosystem that there was a story to tell, but I wanted to tell it in a way that was consistent with all the other things that we've done. And kind of the final frame of it was, I really started off with this idea. The National Football League was a microcosm of the country, especially coming out of 2017. And then I came to the conclusion at the end of the book that America is becoming more and more run like the National Football League. Those were my ideas. The most unbelievable thing is that there was a publisher who actually agreed with me. So I thought it was interesting. But having the good folks at Random House, the editors there were tremendous. And I just came out with a great story that, you know, really wanted to put that last piece of family.
Tim read it. I listened to it, which was great. What's the reaction been? You mentioned, you know, you're not expecting too many holiday gifts from the NFL owners, but how has the reaction been really among the players that you may have spoke to?
I haven't heard a lot from players, and that's not terribly surprising. I've heard far more from former players. They loved it. Again, there's never been that story told from that perspective of the player. You know, the most interesting, you know, and honestly, the one of the more fascinating reactions, at least to me, has been the traditional journalist press, you know, everybody from Politico to Atlantic to the Wall Street Journal to the Times. You know, it's been great for that kind of response because I wanted to write a book that every journalist would appreciate for the fact checking, the, to your point, the specificity of the book.
Yeah, right.
The absolute silence from the majority of sports journalists has been interesting, but not surprising. I kind of have come to the conclusion that the critiqued rarely love the critique. And I'm absolutely fine with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And well, I can tell you, I mean, reading it as a journalist who's written quite a bit about NFL business, and for your context and Demoris and the context of people out there, you know, mine is covering the deal for the Buffalo Bills stadium. So so your world with the players, but very, very much so.
I read everything you wrote.
And I would imagine, and my guess is without even you and I having any discussion about it, and I've said, and I will say this on reflection too, I think there's quite a bit to critique about what I wrote, what I asked, what I didn't ask. You got me thinking with this book. And John, when we're reflecting on our conversation later with Demoris, you and I can jump into that a little bit more. But Demoris, there's something you wrote. I have it down here in front of me. I'm going to read it to you and for everybody listening and watching. This was in the context of Bountygate, which is going back about 10 years, a little more than 10 years.
Wow.
When the New Orleans Saints were found to be putting a bounty on taking out guys from the other team. Yep. You wrote, "I couldn't believe how many people were willing to lie, cheat, steal, or just go along with whatever the league wanted them to do." Tell us about that realization you came to and you know, with the bigger messages behind it.
Yeah, look, I'm permanently either scarred or framed by being a homicide prosecutor as long as I was, and a lawyer as long as I was. When you're in a case, criminal case and a civil case with a big law firm, everybody is hired to take a side. And I'm used to certainly the bare knuckle way in which that game is played. Dealing with the league, that was really the first time that I was met with just sort of a blatant willingness to either ignore the truth or a blatant decision to not tell the truth. I mean, look, again, you come from a world where it's winner take all. And you know, nobody paid my ridiculous hourly salary at Latham & Watkins to be a nice guy. You're used to that. But there were always lines that you just couldn't cross. Whether we were dealing with certain journalists who wrote things that either they wrote and didn't know, or they did know and they wrote them anyway, or you're dealing with the league's investigative memo where it turns out that it's just not true. The willingness to double down on all of that smacks lawyers like me as okay, I get the whole moral unwillingness to abide by the truth part. But, you know, lawyers are literally slaves to the process. And it's that willingness to ignore due process and basic tenets of fairness that I just found shocking. To a certain extent, Bounty was kind of my baptism into the National Football League. And it changed the way that we went about, at least the way that I went about deciding the way in which we were going to react to these things, because I'm sure the league, you know, never really liked the fact that I was willing to fight as public, you know, as they wouldn't want me to do. But that literally becomes the only measure by which there's some level of accountability. And, you know, Bounty ended up, you know, again, you know, at the end, Paul Tagliabue comes in at the end of that and writes an opinion that overturns the suspensions of all of the players. But again, you know, the moral turn of all that, right? The coaches, and by the way, there was enough fault to go around when it came to the coaches, but you know, the coaches, because they weren't represented by a union, had no recourse. And I just found Bounty to be that perfect storm of what's right, what's wrong, what's due process, what's not, what's the role of a union, what's not. It's complicated because on one hand, we're representing players who could have been harmed by that the allegations. At the same time, we have this duty as a union to defend the people. So that was probably the baptism, but I also know that that was the moment where I realized that a majority of my job had to become a teacher. Explaining to the players that, yes, we can defend and protect the players and we are zero sum about health and safety with our left hand. Can we 100% defend the players that we have an obligation to defend with our right hand? Yes. And those two things are exclusive, but they both fall within the purview of the union. And that education process that, frankly, you know, we had to have with players and some sports writers, you know, became that moment where I just kind of realized that, wait a minute, the NFL and sports is this strange ecosystem where, for whatever reason, everybody believes that it should operate without any boundaries that relate to how we conduct ourselves in everyday life.
Yeah, yeah.
I just find that to be strange.
Yeah.
And well, and so
it's getting stranger. It's getting stranger. ESPN owns a piece of the NFL and they own the NFL Network. I mean, it's... Where are the boundaries, to your point?
I think that it is much worse now. Mm-hmm. And again, the parallels to what's happening in the country are unavoidable. The complexity has led to complicity. And then that leads to the lack of accountability. But ESPN is literally a first-year law school's exam of conflicts.
Yeah, right.
Right. I mean, right. You have the NFL owning a piece of an organization that at least part of their arm is to hold the NFL accountable as investigative journalists. You have a group of journalists within ESPN who call themselves insiders, whose literal job is to uncover information that is material and non-public. And their job is to somehow use that material and tell, you know, us, the fans. At the same time, they're promoting gambling, to which they have an ownership interest in. And the last turn of the screw is all of this operates without the traditional boundaries that you would find in a reputable newspaper. What happens if Adam Schefter gets a certain tip about something that has an impact on the line for the game? Does he tell it? Does he not tell it?
Right. Does he have to check things out with people on Park Avenue? Right.
I just, Once again, and right. You know, I wrote an article recently for the Athletic and for the New York Times about gambling, and and herein tis the rub. I'm not really besmirching. Okay, I am the fact that they have that the league has an ownership interest in a news network. I think that's just not good. But if you're going to do it, you know, the way to do it is to be overt and explicit about how we handle conflicts and how we handle accountability structures. I think that when it comes to the human quotient, you know, unlike selling, you know, a can of Coke or a can of soup, sport is one of the few businesses that operates with a human commodity.
Well, it's interesting too. You know, I think back over time, even let's say when daily newspapers, regional and national, were thriving, there would be, you would never see a business reporter or a local government reporter for a daily newspaper share an opinion in print. You'd see the columnists do that, right?
Right.
In sports, big newspapers and small ones back in the day, and certainly now, the beat reporter will opine on any number of topics, whether it's on social media or in print. And it does go beyond analysis too. So it feels like John, I'm sure you've seen this from the inside. I mean, that line in sports has always been blurred.
Yeah.
It feels like it's that blurriness might be in a more dangerous spot right now. Is that fair to say, Demoris?
I think it's definitely in a dangerous spot because I think the greatest risk we have in our democracy is when we believe that things that should not be normal become normalized. When journalists in the sports world don't report that they're going to parties paid for by the National Football League, I think that's a problem. I think when they have their own exclusive Super Bowl junkets, I think it's a problem. I think if ESPN opens every day without telling the viewers that this is a company that is partially owned by the subject that we are covering, I think it's deliberately disingenuous.
Yeah.
And then it becomes normal. You know, to me, is there a straight line between you wake up one morning and my hometown newspaper gets raided by the FBI? They're executing search warrants at the Washington Post. I'm not going to make any judgment on how old we are, but all of us who are in this remember a thing called Watergate, and not even Nixon served subpoenas on the Washington Post or on Woodward or on Bernstein.
Right.
Yeah.
I think the last line of defense for democracy has always been the Fourth Estate. You know, I did a show for CBS and you know, okay, they just aired the Venezuela story yesterday for the first time. You know, I teach a class called Leadership, Law, and Ethics in Sport, and I've taught it now for a version of it for 8 years. It takes everybody about 5 weeks to realize that I'm not teaching a sports class. I'm teaching an America class. If you can use sport and talk about the NFL, if you can use sport and talk about, okay, what does the Rooney Rule really mean? Yes, we're talking about race. Maybe I'm also talking about that this is still one of the greatest challenges that America has never learned to reckon with. If you can talk about due process, you know, whether it's bounty or Deflategate, you can talk about the roles of unions and the necessity of having clear-cut boundaries in the law. So, you know, when you can take issues of race, gender, power, class, and talk about it with sports, it becomes a really good Gedanken experiment, right, for talking about it in the country. Now, that's also why almost every bro guy drops my class by week by week five.
But Demoris, here's why it's, you know, there's some of our listeners saying, oh, it's only sports. It's only football. Why does it matter? You know, here's why it matters, because, yes, it is about equality. It is about due process. It's also about economy and tax, you know, incentives. I mean, it's not just about sports. And if there's no one, you know, watching, you know, the chicken coop here, you know, it's coming out of our pocketbooks and, you know, it goes beyond that. So it's not just about the NFL.
I mean, it's no mistake that the NFL goes out of its way to brand football with America. And I think that's great. I just think that if you want to talk about America, let's just talk about it truthfully and honestly, as opposed to the kind of the convenient 4x4 flyover version. And No, I mean, there's no way that I would ever want to do my job, you know, representing Colin Kaepernick and somehow divorce that from sport. You're talking about, at least this year, what, a $24 billion industry that just gave up their 501c6 nonprofit status a few years ago.
Crazy. Yeah.
It's crazy.
And, it's crazy. Yeah.
And I get it, but, you know, that becomes a very convenient way to talk about our interesting tax policy. You know, I have always tried to use sport as a professor. You can force these sort of very clean conversations about, okay, should a 25 or back then $14 billion a year business have a 501c6 nonprofit status? We can talk about that. For some reason, that is a much cleaner conversation than if you then move over and say, hey, we should change our tax policy to perhaps getting, you know, more tax revenue from people who earn more than $1 billion. For all of a sudden, then you're getting in whole sorts of conversations about the free enterprise system and the founding fathers. And that's what the, I mean, like, I get it. But man, if you talk about it in the context of football, everybody goes, well, wait a minute, that's insane.
Right.
Well, Zamora, here's a simple point you made in the book that really struck me. For many NFL players, that first team they're on, that's their first job.
Yeah. You know,
these are guys who went through high school,
yeah,
college, really devoted to a sport, but not doing a paper route, not working at McDonald's, not serving coffee.
That's a problem, because, you know, you take that realistic lack of understanding your role as an employee, and then you layer it, right, with this is my hope and my dream. And when I get drafted, I'm going to walk across the stage and I'm going to hug Roger Goodell like, you know, that he has given me something. Roger hasn't given you anything. I mean, if you weren't one of the top 250 players in the country, there's no hug. I mean, that dude's not walking down Park Avenue just handing out hugs every day. The problem becomes, you know, you lack sort of a fundamental understanding of the difference between management and labor. You're at a point where this is the only thing that you've ever dreamed of. And, you know, and here comes some short guy into your locker room, you know, like banging a table, you know, talking about the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire and Ludlow. And you got a bunch of guys looking like, okay, this guy is absolutely insane. But you have to shock them out of this idea that the league is their benefactor. Because the first thing that you understand, whether you have a paper route or for me, I was working at a pizza place. You know, the first thing that you realize when you have any one of those minimum wage jobs, you realize that, man, the only thing they really want from you is you come to work. Nobody cares about whether you've had a bad day, girlfriend problems, boyfriend problems, problems at home. You don't feel particularly well. You're trying to juggle all that. Nobody cares. It's a pure transactional relationship where I come to work, I do the work, I get paid, and then I leave. Trying to convince players of that transactional relationship is, as you can imagine, antithetical to everything they hear, everything. And so what I try to tell a group of young people, you know, the reason why you have a pension, the reason why you've got limitations on the number of your hours, the reason why you've got access to a 401k, to workers' comp, to benefits, and if anything goes wrong, somebody from the union is going to ride in and wage war on your behalf. The only reason you have those things is players before you realized that this was a transactional relationship.
You brought up concussions and player safety, and you're correct. We were going to as well. As you look back, how do you assess the work you did and your role in where you were able to get things? I mean, how much more is there to go? Do you feel okay about where you got it?
I feel tremendously proud, and it had very little to do with me and a lot to do with the player leadership back then. You know, I look at, I did watch the Patriots-Texans game, and, you know, to think that D'Amico Ryans and Mike Vrabel were both union reps, you know, during that war in 2011, you know, the guys who really embraced this idea that we could actually make the game safer were two linebackers. And so I'm really happy about where it was. I mean, I think, you know, I'll get to the, I think your question at the end is, are you happy where things are? The answer is no, because I think from where we started, I think the job of a union leader is to never be happy where things are with health and safety. I know I learned sitting at the right side of Rich Trumka, who represented coal miners for most of his life. I don't think Rich was ever happy about the state of health and safety for a coal miner. It's better. But to think that when I took the job in 2009, the head of the league's concussion committee was a rheumatologist. The name of the committee was the Mild Traumatic Brain Injury Committee. Anybody who can put mild
right
in front of traumatic brain,
moron.
Only yeah. The National Football League can put mild in front of traumatic brain injury. And to think sideline concussion experts didn't exist. Baseline testing didn't exist. Concussion protocols didn't exist. And now I am pretty sure that there probably isn't a kid in junior high school who plays sports that hasn't had a baseline testing. And if something bad happens, doesn't go through some version of a concussion protocol. And so I'm really happy that something we did, you know, trickled down all the way to youth sports. What I'm not happy about, frankly, is it's still so hard for players, and some of it is self-inflicted, to get everything they are due with workers' compensation. And why is it important? Because workers' comp gives every injured player lifetime health care for the injuries they suffer at work. Lifetime. And so, you know, that became, I'm going to throw, it's going to be a rough stat. You know, I'm not going to die on the hill, but my guess would be that when I took the job in 2009, I bet most teams averaged less than 30% of the players either seeking or getting workers' comp. By the time I left, that was in probably its high 60s. But when you talk about, again, in America, what leads most families to bankruptcy or economic hard times? An uncovered medical cost, right? And so within the NFL system, the union fought for workers' comp. The fact that that rate isn't, the fact that the rate of players getting workers' comp isn't the same rate as the 100% of the players who get injured, I still consider that a loss.
Yeah. DeMorris, as we look to wrap up, are there other things that you'd like to see or you wish we could all see over the next couple of years when it comes to the players in the league?
I think, you know, that there's you can't avoid sort of a certain narrative of, you know, I've watched what's happened with the NFLPA since I left. And that's been, frankly, heartbreaking to watch for so many reasons. And I'm sure there are tons of reasons. My worry is that over time, and again, it's one of the things that I constantly look at, maybe it's my failure, that inability to cultivate the D'Amico Ryans, the Mike Vrabels, the Jeff Saturdays, the Dominique Foxworths, the Drew Breeses, you know, the Tom Brady, the Peyton Manning, you know, those were guys who stepped up to the plate in a major way for the entire time that I was the executive director. And it made the job of being the tip of that spear, you know, really easy, because it was easy to frame the job that I work for what's in the best interest of the players, and man, literally everything else be damned. You know, it certainly wasn't an easy job, but that part wasn't hard. I think the thing that worries me now is again, going back to the country, man, apathy is our greatest enemy. And the history of progress in this country, whether it's women's rights, civil rights, fair wage, 40-hour work weeks, pensions. I mean, Saul Alinsky told this wonderful story about Rochester, New York, and the workers there battling the Kodak plant. My only question is left is now is, do we have people who are willing to fight?
That next generation of leadership among the teams, right? That's what we're kind of looking for.
Well, right? and man, you know, focusing on what matters, you know, the battles with the league. And by the way, you know, we really didn't spend a lot of time talking about my BFF, Roger Goodell, and, you know, we're so close, but, you know, I have to tip my cap to them. They're really good. He and the league are the most formidable people that I have ever gone up against in my, whatever it is, 35 years of being a lawyer. The only reason we got anything was the willingness of the players to engage in the fight. And somewhere along the line, I think, there became this sort of convenient narrative that maybe fighting is wrong. Maybe we should somehow try to find, you know, mutual ground, and maybe we should engage the owners as equal partners in this thing. They will never view you as an equal partner. And anything along that lines is sophistry. You know, my hope is that a union that Gene built and Ed Garvey built and I inherited, my hope is that they fix the things that they need to desperately fix and engage, because I do believe that, you know, this deal, this collective bargaining agreement is up in 2030. The league is going to make a decision about how they're going to fight the players within the next 12 months.
And I think Turf Wars, the book you wrote, I wish we could have it as mandatory reading for any player in the league or any player who's looking to, you know, be fortunate enough to play in the league, because I think these, this dialogue and, you know, these topics, you know, are mandatory reading in my mind. And I just thank you for bringing this up. And also really want to encourage our listeners, you know, even if you're not necessarily a diehard fan of the NFL, this is also, I think, as you said, a little bit of a history book as well. So we encourage folks to pick up Turf Wars.
Man, thank you. Those are kind words. And, you know, I really appreciate it. And look, for folks who want to dive into the bone marrow and crawl through it and really appreciate the business of the business, you know, thank you guys for having this podcast and having me on.
Oh, we so appreciate having you, DeMorris. Thank you.
It's awesome. Awesome. Thank you, guys. This is a blast.
Thank you.
Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Support for BTPM comes from our members and from Holiday Valley. Holiday Valley was voted the number 4 resort in the East by Ski Magazine readers. More snowmaking, more lifts, more ways to play. Holiday Valley is a mix of exciting terrain on an independent mountain that brings out your best. From the first chair to the last run, Holiday Valley is what winter was made for. Holiday Valley, your winter done right. More information at holidayvalley.com.
Hey, welcome back to Skin in the Game. And again, DeMorris Smith, thank you for joining us on the program today. Tim, I want to really also thank you for bringing DeMorris Smith into the podcast.
You're not mad at me for making you read yet another book?
No, and actually, as I said, I did listen to it. Quite interesting. And I got to say, we do need to bring DeMorris back onto the show because there's so, so much to dig into.
I've got a whole list of questions here, John, and I know you do too. We didn't even come close to getting to. And by the way, for folks out there who, you know, as much as I joke about getting John to read a bunch of books here on Skin in the Game, we're both avid readers. We've both read quite a bit this year. This book is especially well written. I'll tell you what, it's an easy read, but man, John, it's a tough
comprehensive
read.
Comprehensive though. I mean,
it's comprehensive. And I can tell you too, and I'm saying this from the sports journalist, longtime, you know, football business journalist side, it's a tough read that makes you question yourself. And, you know, he and I got into that a bit in the conversation. And there's some NFL executives and other NFL figures who I'm quite fond of personally, who he takes the task. And that is okay. That is good. That is great. He holds absolutely no punches, and I respect that.
The bottom line is the NFL is big, big business. The players are employees who in many cases are, you know, non-guaranteed contracts. You know, what I found great about the book as well as DeMorris is his job was simple. I'm representing the best interests of the players. And he had, and if you read the book, you know, encourage our listeners to do that. These were battles that he had forged, you know, to defend the players, to defend the rank and file, you know, when he went up against the machine, which is the NFL. Some really interesting stories. You know, the one that I wanted to get into, DeMorris, and I'm not going to discourage people from reading it, but there's a great, great chapter about that insurance policy that he took out on behalf of the players should they go on strike. And that was in
master
many ways the silver bullet, you know, that saved a season. just remarkable story and the attention to detail to to recount that story.
Yeah, a $47 million insurance premium that the NFLPA paid, and give the players the ability to say, well, yeah, lock us out, see how long you last. And we'll put it this way, fans got to see a lot more football that particular season because of DeMaurice Smith's strategy. And so
exactly.
Yeah, you talk about drawing a line.
There was also the story with him and his relationship with Tom Brady to ultimately get the news back to Robert Kraft, who then got that news back to the rest of the owners.
Right.
And completely changed the dynamic of those negotiations.
It's a gripping story at times. Yeah. John, you bring up Tom Brady. Here's an interesting one. I was laughing a little as I read this. Brady, as is well known, earns tens of millions, hundreds of millions playing football. But I think the number is 60, by some projections, perhaps 60 million, 6-0 million less than he could have. You know, the story goes he wanted to give Robert Kraft and the Patriots the ability to sign other guys or keep other guys. So he gave up a little bit of money, and at 60 million is a little bit.
A little bit,
right?
Yeah, right.
A little bit, just 60. And if you're DeMaurice Smith running the NFLPA, that is not a good thing because you want to set that standard, in this case, of the position of quarterback, as high as possible. It drives up every other quarterback's salary. Same thing is true, usually for less money, at the other positions too.
Great insights. You know, what we didn't get into, and we're going to get DeMaurice back on, you know, we didn't get into the evolution of now private equity going into the NFL ownership, the influence, and I think DeMaurice did allude to the negative influence of gambling, you know, in the sport. You know, it's going to be interesting to see how those evolve over the next few months and years. But a great conversation, super interesting guy. And, you know, we could have talked to him for hours and hours, and we will get him back.
Oh, for sure. It'll be great. I want to throw, before we wrap, John, I do want to throw in one other tidbit that you and I didn't get a chance to talk about, but I'm guessing this jumped out at you too. The CBA, collective bargaining agreement that DeMaurice helped negotiate, you know, about 15 years ago, that addressed the salary cap and mm-hmm. the spending floor on the
right.
salary cap and forced every team to spend at least 89% of whatever the cap was that year. There were a few teams, and some of these will be familiar to our listeners. The Buffalo Bills were one. The Cincinnati Bengals were another. The Kansas City Chiefs were a third. Buffalo, KC, and Cincinnati, among others, were consistently spending below that floor. They weren't coming anywhere near the cap until they were mandated to do so. And around the time they were mandated to do so, their on-field performance started going up and up and up. And so I just named three, not this year, but three over the years, perennial contenders.
Right.
You know, so again, you want to look at how can a union chief impact what happens on the field and what fans see. That's another way right there.
Yeah, and I think that's really helped the league in terms of parity. You know, we don't see that in Major League Baseball. You know, the discrepancy between the Dodgers and the Pirates payrolls, for example, are hundreds of millions of dollars apart. So I think from an NFL perspective, having that cap and that floor has really helped with the balance of the league. And I think ultimately that's good for fans because whatever market you live in, you want to know your team at least has a chance, right?
Any given Sunday. That's a phrase he doesn't always take too kindly in the book. But yeah, on any given Sunday, or at least any given year, every team theoretically has a chance. And you can believe that in football.
Yeah. So again, Turf Wars is the book. DeMaurice Smith, the former executive leader with the NFLPA, is the author. Encourage everyone to go out there and read it, and think there'll be something of interest to any sports fan or, quite frankly, fan of business.
Absolutely. It's a good read. It's a tough read. It's a necessary read. Have at it. John, we'll see you next week.
This is a production of Buffalo Toronto Public Media. Thanks for listening.